From California to Massachusetts, Minnesota to New Jersey, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, with a landmark Supreme Court ruling saying they can, many individuals are seeking to leave public sector labor unions. In Connecticut, one local union is trying to disaffiliate with the state union. Nathan McGrath of the Fairness Center is here with details. All eyes are on the partial government shutdown, but beneath the surface, the fight over executive authority to impose tariffs continues to rage. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Democrat socialism is all the rage on the American left, but in Venezuela, socialism has brought about economic and political havoc. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Doug Bandow from the Cato Institute. And the Jim Jones cult that ended in mass suicide shocked the world over 40 years ago. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College talks about how Jones was a prominent left-wing activist on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. In a landmark ruling last summer, the Supreme Court of the United States affirmed the First Amendment right of public sector employees not to be forced into joining or otherwise supporting a labor union. Now even some local unions are seeking their independence. Nathan McGrath is Vice President and Director of Litigation at the Fairness Center. He joins us now with details. Nathan, welcome to American Radio Journal. Nathan, before we get into the issues and where this case is going involving firefighters, Local 825, give us a little bit of background. What is the case about and how did it get started?
There are a lot of details, so let me try to give you a quick view of what's happened. So back in 2016, our client, Local 825, the New Haven Firefighters, their executive board voted to disaffiliate, to leave their state the state union. So I don't know how much you know about this, but the structure of unions, there's typically an international or national level, there's a state affiliate level, and then there's the local level. So our clients wanted to remain members of IAFF, the International Association of Firefighters, but they wanted to leave the state affiliate, which is called UPFFA of Connecticut. And so they voted to do so. And they had a couple different reasons for that. One, they didn't feel like they were getting good representation. The other was they wanted to bring their financial house in order. And so this new administration that was in said, you know, one way we can save about $30,000 is to leave and represent ourselves at the Capitol, which they're very qualified to do. So they took the vote and they notified the state affiliate. And the state affiliate decided, nope, we don't think you can do that, and we don't want you to do that. Obviously, it'd be a big income loss for them as well. And so they began 2 years, basically, of discussions back and forth and trying to get our clients to reaffiliate and come back into the union. And finally, our clients held strong and said, no, it's our right not to, and we don't want it. And they were not paying them for this time because they weren't receiving services and they didn't want to be part of the state affiliate. So the state affiliate actually sent them into collections, and it got so bad that the collections agency was calling the family members of some of our clients' officers' family. So it was crazy. And so then the collections agency actually recommended a lawsuit against our client. And that's when our client came to us and said, hey, we need legal help. Can you help us out here? So we stepped in and we filed a lawsuit on their behalf. And the lawsuit, pretty simple. At first, it asks the court to affirm that our clients disaffiliated properly and that they're no longer members of the state affiliate. And the second part is, through this process, our client found out that a lot of money was not being spent on legislative activity, which in the state affiliate, there's two types of membership, a full membership where your money goes towards everything. And then there's legislative only, which is typically the bigger local unions only do legislative only because that's the only services they really want. And all their money, they were under the impression, was going towards legislative activity up at the Capitol in their best interest. And they found out through the process of disaffiliating that they were actually paying for many other things, collective bargaining and travel and all types of things for all other local unions around the state of Connecticut and for UPFFA leadership.
So we have a situation where the local wants to disaffiliate and the parent union doesn't want to let them. What comes into play here, Nathan? Is this an issue that's governed by federal law and therefore this could have a national impact, or are there state laws or a combination of both?
Well, it certainly is a theme that we're finding around the nation, whether it's individuals who want to leave their unions or in this case, a union that wants to leave a larger affiliate union. The membership issue is a hot topic right now, and it could be federal law, it could be state law, constitutional rights, or just contract rights. In our case, it's more contractual and at the state level. In fact, the court in a memorandum that he wrote in December during a preliminary injunction hearing said that he actually found as a matter of law that that our client had disaffiliated from the state affiliate. And so that's under Connecticut law.
As we look at federal law, and I realize that this is a bit of a different situation, we did have the landmark U.S. Supreme Court ruling last summer, Janus v. AFSCME, which upheld the First Amendment rights of workers to not be required, public sector workers, to not be required to join a labor union. Given that bent of the Supreme Court of the United States, does that have any impact on this, or could it be influencing the thinking of the judge in the matter?
Well, I don't know if it's doing that, but I'll tell you what's really important here. So you had Janus, and just briefly for your listeners, the Janus decision said people who are not members of the union do not have to pay the union any monies unless they affirmatively consent to do so. And so, but what's so important about the membership issue, which is important in this case and important around the country right now, is that individuals don't get to exercise their so-called Janus rights unless they're non-members of the union. So the unions have started to really put up a firewall all around the country as far as, well, we may not be able to force you to pay us money when you're a non-member, but now we're not going to let you out. And so there's many people that we've been in touch with, Ashley, who have been trying to leave their union, and the unions have been giving them a runaround, whether it's procedurally or just not getting back to them. They're trying to keep these people from getting out and exercising their Janus rights. So that's why I say membership is a really hot topic around the country for a lot of different reasons.
Relative to this specific case involving the firefighters in Connecticut, you referenced the fact that there was a preliminary injunction that allowed the case to go forward on its own merit. So where does it go to from here? What's the next step?
Our clients have won a preliminary injunction to stop, basically to keep a status quo on their case. And where it goes to from here is we're going to be entering a discovery phase where our clients have asserted that, you know, they've misused our money, they misrepresented things to us. And so we're going to be combing through documents and doing a lot of discovery to find out how exactly was their money used and was it all used properly or not. And in the court's opinion, actually, for the preliminary injunction motion, the court even said the court's heard evidence from the local of questionable expenditures from the state union, including personal travel that may not have been reimbursed, suspicious mistakes with PAC fund balances, and the admission of a plainly improper loan that the state took and repaid from its charitable affiliate. So there's a lot for us to dig into there over the next couple months to really get down to the merits of this case.
And we'll continue to keep an eye on this as it unfolds over the upcoming months, perhaps years. Nathan McGrath is with the Fairness Center. He is the Vice President and Director of Litigation. Nathan, tell us just a bit about the Fairness Center and where can folks go on the internet to learn more?
The Fairness Center, we represent for free those who have been injured or hurt by public sector union officials. So that can include individual people, or in this case, the case we are talking about, an actual local union or an organization. So you can find us at fairnesscenter.org, and you can get involved. You can submit for a free legal aid request. You can donate there, or you can just read about our cases and see what we do there.
Nathan McGrath of the Fairness Center. Nathan, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is the time where typically Andy Roth from the Club for Growth joins us, and we talk about things that are happening politically around the country. We talk about what's happening in Congress. Andy, after 15 years with the Club for Growth, has decided to become an entrepreneur and move into his own private business. And The Club for Growth now has a new Vice President of Government Affairs. So we welcome to American Radio Journal Scott Parkinson. Scott, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be with your listeners and with you and talk about what's going on in Washington.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself before we get into a couple of very important issues today.
I've been in Washington for a little bit over 13 years. I have experience in the United States Senate and in the U.S. House of Representatives as a congressional staffer. I worked for three United States senators, John Ensign, Ron Johnson, and Marco Rubio. And then in the House of Representatives, I was the executive director of the Republican Study Committee, which is the largest conservative caucus in the House of Representatives. Most recently, I was chief of staff to Congressman Ron DeSantis, and he has won the governorship down in Florida. And from November up until Inauguration Day on January 8th, I was the deputy executive director of his transition team, helping him set up the Florida state government. I have two daughters and reside in Arlington, Virginia with my wife, and really just excited about the new opportunity here at the Club for Growth to serve as the Vice President of Government Affairs.
Well, Scott, we're certainly glad to have you with us, and certainly you've worked for some great Americans throughout your career. Looking forward to you having huge impact at the Club for Growth. And speaking of huge impacts, let's now talk a little bit about some policy matters. I know everybody's focused on the government shutdown, and one of the issues that's perking below the media radar here, which aside from the shutdown and maybe the kids at Cummington High School, everything's below the radar, but we still have ongoing issues, Scott, with trade and the president wanting to or having already put certain tariffs on certain sectors of the economy. Congress has some different views on that. So give us a bit of the lay of the land as to what's happening in Congress.
Over the past week or so, the United States Reciprocal Trade Act, which is going to be sponsored by Congressman Sean Duffy from Wisconsin, has been floating around. There's been draft text, legislative text of the bill that has been leaked to the media, so we've had a chance to review the proposal. And it's really alarming, to be quite honest. I think that what it does is it capitulates and deteriorates the Article I authorities that the legislative branch has in order to increase taxes, because it allows the president to unilaterally increase taxes on Americans who buy goods and services from foreign sources. We believe that members of Congress should oppose the policy because there are specific enumerated powers on the regulation of commerce and taxes within Article I. The legislation would certainly expand the administrative state, and we just don't believe that the president should have the unilateral authority to increase taxes in this fashion through tariffs. We believe tariffs are taxes, and when an administration is given new authority to increase tariffs, it's inevitable that the executive overreach will occur.
Is this sort of in line, Scott, with what's been a general trend in Congress, where they tend to pass legislation and hand off their congressional authority to bureaucrats in the executive branch? Do you see this as being an extension of that?
Absolutely. When you look at the vision of our founding fathers, they wanted a very strong Article I that was representative of the American people and would be able to hold the executive branch and the judiciary accountable when they veered off course through their own constitutional responsibilities. In this fashion, we've seen a historic trend where many members of Congress have wanted to strengthen the executive, meaning the President of the United States, and giving him additional authority. But in the end, it creates additional bureaucracies and strengthens executive branch bureaucrats' ability to do things sort of through the night of day, and instead of really having transparency with legislative action and debate on the House and Senate floor, it allows for this executive action and promulgation of new executive authorities.
Speaking of dodging the bullet, as it were, in terms of taking tough votes in Congress, there's some move by Democrats to reinstate an old rule relative to raising the debt limit. With Andy last week, we talked, Scott, about the fact that the national debt continues to skyrocket. What are the Democrats up to?
When Republicans took power of the House of Representatives in the 2010 elections, beginning in 2011, they repealed House Rule 28, which was known as the Gephardt Rule. The Gephardt Rule allowed the House to pass debt limit increases without requiring a separate vote on the consideration of the actual debt limit increase. What they would do in the Gephardt Rule is pass a congressional budget resolution, and then they would, through procedural motion, pass the actual debt limit increase. Now, that's not a transparent process for the American people. Nobody understands that, you know, we're doing these trillion-dollar debt limit increases basically through procedural motions, and there's not the roll call vote where you can hold your member of Congress accountable when they use the Gephardt Rule. So that's something that the Democrats are very, very interested in bringing back. It was a precedent that they began in 1980 and used for 30 years, and they were pretty successful most of the time in using that rule to move a debt limit increase. We're in a situation now where the debt and deficit is reaching over $1 trillion for the current fiscal year. I think that that's a dangerous recipe for elections, and you know, there's a lot of fiscal conservatives that care about the mounting debt that we've had from 2011 up until last year, when Republicans controlled the House, and then for the last several years we've controlled the United States Senate. We've still seen a repeated effort from congressional leadership to go ahead and increase the debt limit without specific reforms that will get our debt and deficit issues under control.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson, the new Vice President of Government Affairs at the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a bit about the club, if you will, and also what is the club's website for folks who'd like to learn more?
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We have over 250,000 members from all across the country, all walks of life, and from all 50 states in the union. We're united because we believe in economic freedom. And if your listeners are interested, they can go to our website, which is www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can actually join as a member for free.
Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, good to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
Venezuela's economy has been devastated by its socialist dictators. Now a governmental crisis is gripping the country. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine discusses the situation with Doug Bandow from the Cato Institute. Eric?
The crisis in Venezuela has been something of a slow burn for a while, just the sort of decay that we've seen over and over again for the past century in countries that have embraced socialism. People are hungry, people are fleeing, and the military is cracking down on dissidents. But things have gotten a little bit more crazy there in the past week or so. We've seen some major protests in the streets of Caracas and other cities in Venezuela, and now two people claiming to be the rightful president of the country. Is this a sign of hope, or is it the beginnings of what could be a dangerous civil war? Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. We are going to ask some of those big questions to my guest today. It's Doug Bandow. He is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. He covers foreign policy and has been following the crisis in Venezuela for quite some time. Doug, thanks for taking some time and being here on the show with us.
Sure. Happy to be on.
Let's start, before we talk about what the United States needs to do here, Doug, let's start with the crazy scenes we saw this week in Caracas, big protests that were marking the anniversary of a 1958 uprising when the people of Venezuela threw off a military dictatorship. And in the midst of all that, you have now two people, actually, of this opposition leader who is claiming that he is the rightful president of the country, or the interim president of the country, in an attempt to dispose of current President Nicolas Maduro. Tell us what's going on down there.
This is a country that's been in crisis for quite some time. I mean, in essence, the government has, you know, given up much pretext that it's a genuine democracy. It's a military dictatorship, effectively. But the National Assembly, which exists but had essentially been sidelined, made the claim that they are deposing the president and they put one of their own in his stead. So you have one guy who's nominally the elected president, who's really completely illegitimate, but has all the power. then you have somebody else now where they're trying to kind of raise the population by bringing him forward as a legitimate contender. But his problem, of course, is he doesn't have power, but he did bring a lot of people into the streets, so I think it shows that there's a lot of popular support for him.
So you've got all these people marching in the streets, marching in support of the opposition leader Juan Guaido. I might be pronouncing his name wrong, but the military is still backing Maduro, still backing Nicolas Maduro, who has been the president since Hugo Chavez died in 2013. So on one side, you've got all the people, or a lot of people, and on the other side, you've got all the guns and the military, and that, to me, that seems like a recipe for bloodshed. Should we be worried?
That, I think, is the fear in Venezuela. The desperation level is extraordinary. People can barely eat. 10% of the population has fled. Hospitals don't operate. You know, the only people who are okay are those who are in the elite, who basically get to steal whatever is there. Massive numbers of people are desperate. That's likely to keep them to coming into the street. I mean, the challenge for the opposition is it's always been divided. It's always had trouble working together. He seems to be somebody who's been able to bring them all together, and that's what they've desperately needed.
And it didn't take long yesterday for the United States, Canada, other countries around the world. They quickly recognized the opposition leader, Guaido, as the legitimate president of Venezuela, for whatever that's worth, as this all plays out. We are talking with Doug Bondo. He is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, and he's been following the developments in Venezuela for quite some time. Now the United States has recognized Guaido as the legitimate leader down there. Beyond that, what is the role for the United States? What is the role for President Trump? What should he be doing here as this crisis continues to unfold?
Well, this is a tough case. And again, we see this in a lot of places. Zimbabwe has been going through this for a long time. Now it's further away from us. But you had a tyrant who basically destroyed what was once the breadbasket of Africa and reduced these people to poverty. We've long had the spectacle of North Korea. There are a lot of other countries where you've seen kind of these horrendous, you know, circumstances. It strikes me, you really can't justify military action. I mean, there are a lot of unpredictabilities that come out of that. I think you have to, that is a last resort. That's really, you use that when there are significant security issues at stake for our own community. I don't think that's the case here. But it certainly makes sense to try to help the Venezuelan people. I think certainly using kind of the bully pulpit, pointing out what's going on down there. The main thing I think here is for the U.S. to support local leaders. We see across South America, virtually every country is appalled by this. I mean, the Cubans are like the Venezuelans because they're, you know, they're basically fellow left-wing dictators. But for the most part, you look at almost every other country is appalled by this, Organization of American States and others. So what the U.S. wants is this to be seen not as, you know, Yankee imperialism, but wants to see that as people in the neighborhood who are affected by this, threatened by this, concerned about fellow South Americans, fellow members of that broader community. We want them to take the lead. So I think the U.S. wants to indicate it's willing to help any way it can, but also try to give as much space for other countries to push forward on this.
Last thing then before I let you go, Doug, what complicates all of this situation in Venezuela is the fact that the country has some of the biggest oil reserves, by some measures, the biggest oil reserves anywhere on the planet. How much does that matter for U.S. foreign policy here? How much does that enter into the strategy?
I don't think you can use the kind of oil as a justification here. The good news is that we have kind of a plentiful oil market. I mean, the United States itself has become the top energy producer in the world because of fracking. I think the reality here is, long term, one reason we would like Venezuela to stabilize is because of that energy. But at the moment, that's really not the primary issue here. There's no security interest. I mean, we're not desperate for that oil. The real issue is the impoverishment, the devastation that's being visited upon the Venezuelan people.
Yeah, definitely a complex situation. Lots of different humanitarian and economic and political factors at play here. So far, I think you have to say the Trump administration has handled this pretty well, and hopefully the involvement continues to be more of that support role rather than anything that involves, you know, the active use of the U.S. military down there. We will see how that goes. Unfortunately, we are out of time for today. Doug Bondo from the Cato Institute, thanks for taking some time and being here with us.
Happy to be on.
And again, that is Doug Bondo. He is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. You can check out his work at cato.org. Check out our coverage of Venezuela and everything else that's going on in politics at reason.com. And for Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. We'll get you right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The Jim Jones cult's mass suicide shocked the world, but before it happened, he was a prominent member of this nation's left-wing establishment. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College explains on this American Radio Journal commentary.
It was this time 40 years ago that Americans turned on their evening news and absorbed the crazy, grisly details of the bizarre Jim Jones cult, which produced the shocking murders mass suicide of 918 people at a remote jungle outpost in South America. To this day, the Jones cult embodies the infamous image of Kool-Aid drinkers. That was because the members of the Reverend Jim Jones People's Temple had ingested collectively a fatal admixture of cyanide and Flavor Aid in a sugary elixir administered to hundreds of them in faraway Guyana. Don't drink the Kool-Aid has become an admonition for those who seem to blindly accept whatever a leader is telling them. It especially applies to religious figures in their flock. And yet, the misconceptions about who Jones and his followers truly were is quite remarkable, as shown in a fascinating new book by Daniel Flynn titled Cult City, focused on the surreal San Francisco milieu that not only helped produce Jones, but protected and even praised him throughout the 1970s. Totally neglected then and still today is the reality that Jim Jones was nothing less than a darling of San Francisco's perverse political establishment. Yes, that bears repeating. Jim Jones and his seduced cult had been embraced by the San Francisco political left. Jones's People's Temple was hailed in its heyday by the likes of San Francisco gay icon Harvey Milk, by radicals Huey Newton, Angela Davis, Jane Fonda, and a long line of progressive luminaries. California political legend Willie Brown compared Jones to Martin Luther King Jr. and Albert Einstein. Governor Jerry Brown met with Jones, and the interest in Jones was not limited to only California. Jones met with Vice Presidents Nelson Rockefeller and Walter Mondale and future First Lady Rosalynn Carter. Almost everything you thought you knew about the religious ideological underpinnings of Jim Jones and his gang is wrong. First and foremost, the Reverend Jones and his sect were not fundamentalist right-wing Christians. They were militant socialists and atheist communists. They were not about the Bible. They were about the Communist Manifesto. They were about the USSR as their utopia. Dan Flynn writes, "The supposed religious fanatics of Jonestown had hosted a Soviet delegation. They had taught Russian to residents in preparation for a mass pilgrimage to the place Jim Jones dubbed the group's spiritual motherland, and they willed millions of dollars to the Soviet Union. Jones commonly denounced what he called fascist America. The People's Temple acolytes worshipped not Jesus, but Jim. Jones denounced the stupid sky god of the Christians. They sang songs about Jim rather than Jesus," writes Dan Flynn. "Jonestown celebrated December 25th as Revolution Day. People's Temple goons confiscated Bibles reaching Jonestown from the United States. And what did they do with those Bibles? They treated them like toilet paper, literally," writes Flynn. "When the jungle community ran out of toilet paper, the Reverend Jones distributed Bibles for bathroom use, a practice hitherto unknown among fundamentalist Christians." Alas, the big shocker, of course, is that we don't know any of this. Dan Flynn deserves tremendous credit for exposing and blowing up the outrageous myths surrounding the Jim Jones tragedy. No one ever again should be able to get away with blaming this terrible incident on fundamentalists. If you hear anyone doing so, don't drink the Kool-Aid. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Check out my latest book, A Pope and a President, on Pope John Paul II and President Ronald Reagan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, WYBB-FM in Charleston, South Carolina. Welcome to our new listeners in the Palmetto State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.